Hey everybody, this is John Fusco with No Film School, and you're about to listen to an interview with director Chris Pronofsky and screenwriter Andrew Kevin Walker. They're fresh off the heels of their new movie Nerdland, which premiered at Tribeca, and I give them way too long of an introduction in the actual podcast itself, so I'm going to shut up now and let you guys listen. Okay, enjoy it. Hey guys, this is John from No Film School, and I'm here at Tribeca 2016 with Chris. How do I say your
Pronofsky.
Last name? Pronofsky.
Yeah,
good.
You got it. First try.
No problem. I was practicing a little bit. I was practicing all the different iterations of it. I'm a big fan. He's the founder of Titmouse Inc. They're responsible for creating some of the Adult Swim, I guess, like classics at this point. Like Metalocalypse, Super Jail, Venture Bros, China Illinois, Black Dynamite, and the list kind of goes on, but it's a very distinct style of animation, I'd have to say. If you're not familiar with it, go watch those shows now on Adult Swim, but I imagine, or I hope that most of you are. And I'm also here with Andrew Kevin Walker, who is the screenwriter. We're talking about Nerdland, by the way, which is... their latest film that premiered. When did it premiere?
Last night.
And but I'm here with Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote Seven, among other things, Sleepy Hollow, great screenwriter. And I think we're going to talk mostly sort of about the collaboration between the director and the screenwriter. In this case, it's pretty unique because... The animation and the screenwriting kind of came together to a point where I wasn't really able to tell who came up with what.
Yeah, nice.
That's really
good. You can experience it as a film.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of like intellectually dissecting it.
Right. And I mean, I was, you know, like people like to take notes during films, but I couldn't do it just because it just clipped along at such a fast speed. First of all, there was always something going on, but it was just like an incredibly engaging film. So I guess to start, I would ask, you know, it seems like sort of an unlikely collaboration. Where did you guys meet? Like, how did you first meet and come up with this idea?
Well, Andy put it all into motion, if you want to talk about
it. Yeah, I mean, I'll say here that the person with that cool, kind of happy, nice voice is Chris. And the droning, kind of uninteresting, flat, monotone imbecile is me, Andy. It was an original script that I'd written. I had tried, it was written live action. It's kind of loosely based on mine and my best friend John Silberg's life in Los Feliz, kind of, you know, starting out. And I tried some different versions of trying to get it made, including taking this feature script and breaking it down and going around trying to do it as an animated TV show with a different animation company. And then nobody wanted it. I'm used to that. Then further fractionating, if that's a word, it down into little 5-minute segments to maybe do on the internet. And that didn't work out. And I just kind of regrouped and I went back to the feature script and I tightened it up. And I had been loving every minute of Metalocalypse and Super Jail and all this stuff on Adult Swim that I kept seeing the little chirping bird at the end. I was like, who are these lunatic, you know, geniuses at Titmouse, and how can I meet them? And I eventually, Gavin, my producing partner on this and in many things, Gavin and Pallone and I set up a meeting. I think I maybe came in alone with my script in hand to meet Chris at Titmouse, and I left the script kind of meekly saying, please, sir, will you consider making this into an animated movie, because you guys are off the hook incredible.
Yeah, and then I got that script, and, you know, like there's a lot of stuff where we, you know, we'll write internally with writer's rooms, but then we do a lot of jobs where we will like receive a script from a client, and, you know, so many times my job as a director is to try and make something work that I like. It's a real struggle to look at something on the page and try and be like, man, how am I ever going to make this work? Which was the opposite case with this script. Like, I read it and I was like, I get this. I live this, you know, I have lived this in my past. These are guys that I know and, you know, have known and still know. And our studio, our main studio, we have studios in a couple cities, but our main studio is in Hollywood, like in the movie that you see what it looks like. That's what the neighborhood looks like where our studio is. So it's like, it was super clear to me, like, and I wanted to direct, you know, I don't direct very much anymore. You know, there's so many people at the studio, but I was like, hey man, would you mind if I directed this movie? I really see how it could work.
I just got to say, I mean, I had literally gone to the meeting. It might've been the second meeting where we were talking about where they were, to my great surprise and happiness, were considering doing it. And I went in my mind thinking, I hope I can talk Chris into directing it. I hope I can talk Chris into directing. And then we kind of, that meeting I remember Gavin was at, and we kind of said, well, who would we think about for directing? And just as meekly, he was saying, well, I was thinking maybe me. And I said, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to come and hug you now. And I literally did it in that meeting, but I wanted, and it was like, I was like, thank God.
So what about the script, I guess, if you wrote it as a live action piece, what about it did you see, Chris, that was attractive to you from like an animation standpoint?
Well, you know, we do different kinds of as you know, you're clearly familiar with the material. You know, we do a lot of different kind of cartoons, and a lot of them are not like your standard cartoon. And I really felt like I understood this material. Was like, in on one hand, very cynical, but on the other hand, like very lighthearted, which is this kind of weird meld that I really dig. And the tone of this kind of material in an animated film, I think, feels a little different. There's some things you can heighten a lot more that would be just weird in a live action film. Like the example I'll bring up again is there's a scene where, you know, Paul Rudd's character's like pants rip and then his underwear rips, and we like zoom in on his butt and see his like butthole pucker up. And in a live action film, I think that would be like incredibly disturbing and probably wouldn't get, it got a big laugh at the screening last night. In a live action film, it might just get a sound of disgust from the audience.
I feel like it might not even be allowed shown at theaters.
Exactly. So, you know, you could just take the material and visually, I think you can go places where it would just seem weird. Like, you know, the animation affords you just a different way to tell the story.
Right. And sort of along those lines, you just talked about how it's kind of modeled after where your studio is in LA, but you were able to build like a very distinct world, I feel like. And it's sort of through these like recurring themes, like every single car besides like the car of the protagonist is a Prius or something.
Not technically a Prius. They are Prius.
For legal reasons.
Yeah.
Yes.
It might remind you of a Prius.
A hybrid car of sorts. and you know, there's those recurring themes though throughout. What I was wondering is how much of that, of those visual sort of cues to build that world, were written into the script, and how much of that was just.
And I can definitely answer that. Like, everything good about the movie wasn't in the script, including like everyone's favorite line from Kate from Kate Micucci and Ricky Lindholm. Like, they're like, all their best stuff is like all ad libs, which to my chagrin, but that's what you get when you have genius actors and actresses.
Not all
like
of
that.
It.
I'm just kidding. But I mean, all of the stuff that's like, there's so many beautiful touches that like were unexpected for me because they weren't in the script, and they tie things together, and they, you know, like all the mortar between the bricks that hopefully were supplied, all the mortar and all the other bricks built on that foundation were always like so much better than I could have hoped, and so much like more and a beautiful creative expression of like what animation can do that live action absolutely couldn't do. And to answer that question, like, so much of the stuff that's the touches that are so unique are all Chris and like the animators.
Yeah, Antonio Canobio, who's our production designer and our director on this, he gets a lot of credit for just like, you know, pushing everybody to like be on point and think about the world building of this. And even something else that like another thing that animation affords you to do, right? It's like we, you know, you work on the film in sections and then you sit and screen. It's not like you're watching it from beginning to end every day, you know, and you sit down and screen it every once in a while. We're like, oh man, it feels kind of empty. And Antonio was like, yeah, let's like do a pass where we just populate the world. We just put more people in the background of every, because, you know, you're focused on the main performances and stuff like that. Whereas if you had to shoot a live action film and then go back and either, you know, reshoot stuff or like digitally composite people in, it would be like a, you know, monumental task. But specifically, the thing about the hybrid cars, you know, it's interesting because initially it started as a production concern, right? Because like LA, it's like people drive all over the place. We need to design a bunch of cars. And we started, and I think a designer did a pass of like, you know, we're like, okay, the cars have to be, they have to feel enough like real cars, but they can't be so different from each other because we're not going to be able to make like 1,000 different computer models of cars. So we have to like maybe make like 3 or 4. So they have to be kind of generic. And he drew a bunch and I saw the hybrid car. I was like, oh, that's it. Fuck all these other ones. Just only do that one. And that'll be hilarious because it is kind of like what you see driving around. It also ties into like the point of view of our main characters was like, you know, they have some shitty like late '80s, like, you know, like Nissan hatchback kind of car, like piece of crap car. And everybody, when you're that guy, you feel like everybody has a better car than you, you know, it's like, how come everybody else can have a Prius and I can't, you know? So it's like it became a cool thematic thing that grew out of a production concern.
Definitely. It's interesting how you talk about that process of sort of going back later on in the animation and then looking for spots in the scenes where it might be bare and like being able to, for animation purposes versus live action, you have the ability to go in and sort of layer things in on top of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff we track, like the billboards were something we tracked, or weird little touches I don't think people will pick up until like maybe a third or fourth viewing if they watch the movie that many times. Like I asked Andy to write a bunch of the scroll for the news at the bottom. So there's like a bunch of weird stuff scrolling by at the bottom. And yeah,
I always try and watch those because I really entertain myself writing them. They're super stupid. And like one will be like about a plane crashing into a soup factory and it'll say like dozen scalded. Yeah. But like, yeah, they're not really there for purposes of actually being read, but yeah. I'm the only one trying to read them. I'm like, oh, there's that one that Chris put in.
Well, that's like, I think like one of the most interesting parts of the movie is being able to like watch it to find those details, you know what I mean? Because they're everywhere. Like that's what I mean by it was so engaging as far as like watching it from an audience's perspective.
Nice.
Yeah. We want people to go, I want to go see it again. I want to read that crawl. Yeah. And I know there are a few tiny little Easter eggs in there because having seen it and paused at a certain point, I found one or two things you little bastards were up to.
There was a scan, like in the DVD of all the violent sequences, I could see some of like, some actual scenes from movies. Yeah. Like there were scanners, I think, and like,
maybe inspired by.
Yeah, and there's no actual stuff in there. Yeah. We said,
you bring our lawyer in here. Yeah.
Since the movie does sort of, I mean, it just moves like Metalocalypse moves in the sense of it's just like in your face, like constantly going. There's not much breathing room.
Yeah.
How are you? This is your first feature length.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've done like made for TV movies and stuff, but those are like, you're under such a time constraint on those because they got to come in to the frame of like, you know, this is the TV broadcast length of this. It's a totally different animal. And you're on, you know, you're working with a television network. This was a totally different experience.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that sort of informed your process on this feature from working on those shorter form?
I mean, one of my early jobs was working, I was a, you know, storyboard artist, and I got to direct a section of Beavis and Butthead Do America. It was actually like my first directing job was a sequence where they ingest peyote in the middle of the movie and kind of freak out. Yeah. So like that was a cool film to like be involved in and like see how that all came together at like a very early stage in my career. I was like, I don't know, like 23 or something when I was working on that. And it made me in a weird way like very confident that we could pull this film off because, you know, I think if I had worked on big budget features and stuff, I might have said like, there's no way we can make this movie. But that movie was made in 1 year, from like the time that script was complete to the time it was in the movie theater. That thing was done in 1 year, and that did not have a huge budget. And, you know, we were able to make that.
That's kind of what I would like to see studios do more often. Yeah. Like, you know, that kind of stuff, like make the gigantic animated movies, yeah, but also see some studios step up and make some smaller animated movies too. That would be cool. But this is fully like, we paid for this. We like just made ourselves happy with it. Like we all just kind of linked arms and like did it.
Yeah. But yeah, the pacing was definitely something that, you know, I was thinking about a lot, because you want to make it move. There's a few moments where it slows down, like where we added more time, but it is interesting coming from TV where you're like, you just have to like, you're like, there's a scene where they're like overlooking Los Angeles in the last reel. And, you know, my TV brain was like, I was like, can we make this even longer? Because it seems like insanely long, but for a movie, it's not insanely long. Like it's like, you can have an establishing shot that's like 8 seconds long or something. Whereas in TV, it's like 8 fucking seconds. Yeah. You can't do that. That's against the rules.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like almost a tool that you were using at some point, like extending these scenes to see like how far.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like- or like when they go and get the soda fountain drink.
Yeah, like that part. And then,
yeah,
like,
definitely.
When John is trying to get
Elliot
to get on the same page with him about this plan. And then whole plan is like two sentences, but it kind of draws out for
that. Definitely needs a slow build.
Yeah, for sure. So, Andrew, you say this is semi autobiographical in a way.
Absolutely.
But there is this like sort of major theme about, you know, coming from an acting perspective, like from an aspiring actor or an aspiring screenwriter or an aspiring filmmaker, what like is the ultimate goal you should have as an artist to fulfill yourself, I guess, because like these people are trying to just, you know, become famous.
Right. And I think whether or not they're talented, I think John and Elliot, their hearts are kind of in the right place, because they want to become famous so that they can become a screenwriter and an actor. I mean, they'll probably drop that stuff if they don't need to do that to stay famous. But I don't know. It's interesting. I think that acting is like one of the only showbiz careers that has more rejection and kind of face-to-face rejection than screenwriting. Or disappointment, etc. So, you know, like there's that element of anyone trying to break in or who's even doing it and facing that kind of those kind of closed doors or slamming doors or slaps in the face or disappointments. I think that the film industry is the only business that's kind of exceeded in sleaziness by the film industry is the music business, maybe. So for those who are aspiring, it's like, to get back to your question, it's like writing a spec script, for example, like an original script, and then trying to go out and get an agent with that or sell that script. I mean, I know the spec market does not exist the way it did when I was trying to break in. There's two different ways to go about it. Hey, I wrote this script. Now this is going to open all these doors for me, and this is going to be the one that gets my foot in the door. And or, hey, I wrote this script, and I'm going to try and get this to an agent. I'm going to try and get this to a manager or whomever. And I'm already starting to write my second script, and I've already got an idea for my third script. So to use screenwriting as the example, it's like, are you applying yourself towards your craft? And trying to honestly kind of make it happen? Or are you just thinking like, I'm going to write this script and try and score, and then kind of, you know, it sounds cliche and kind of almost like stupid, but like you really want to be like, you want integrity to be the fulcrum on which your attempt to have a career swings, rather than, you know, just trying to make a big fuss. I do remember certain times where If I wanted to, I could have gotten my name in the paper, like by walking out of a certain, you know, movie premiere or showing up at a movie premiere or something where I didn't belong. Like, it wouldn't have been worth anything, but I knew, like, there are certain times you go, like, if I did this, like, that would be probably in the newspaper and people would know me. I mean, they'd know I was an idiot, but they'd know me. So, you know, I think you have to guide your boat very carefully between the shores of what am I doing to try and serve what I really want to do creatively, and let other people decide whether I have any talent or not. Because if you're doing it right, you're pretty sure you don't have any talent.
This seems like one of those projects where, you know, you really did have that integrity behind it. Because you just said, I mean, it's entirely self-funded. It's sort of a passion project of sorts.
It was definitely a labor of love.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And it became a beautiful, beautiful marriage for me. Because just to digress for 2 seconds, I mean, you write this script and then Titmouse takes it. First of all, the actors elevate the material insanely, because like anybody sits and looks at the list of the actors we got, like Chris was saying to someone earlier, like every single tiny little word out of someone's mouth came from some actor that you know and love, like from Lorraine Newman and like we said, Garfunkel and Oates and Hannibal Buress, et cetera. It's already like better than you ever expected when they're just recording it. Then you see the animatic, then you see the character designs, then you see the, like up until like a few days ago when they made the most beautiful poster I've ever seen, like it's just been amazing. And so it's been all, in my opinion, due to Titmouse.
Well, nice. Thanks, man. It's
well,
the truth.
It was awesome. And
dude, you're nice to say that. Thank you.
No, it was really great. It was really smart. And I really do hope that, you know, we see more animated content like this.
We're hoping that. We hope that desperately.
We're going to try and make more stuff
together. We
want
to do more stuff. Yeah. And now we high five. I know it's the radio, but we're doing it by, the microphone. Slap.
I tried to intentionally, awkwardly high five. By the way, you couldn't see it because this is audio.
But you'll get that reference when you see Nerdland.
We'll draw it. We'll put it on Twitter.
Yeah. So check it out, guys. Thanks for listening. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.
The movie is Nerdland. The site is No Film School. And the podcast is the No Film School podcast. So please remember to go on iTunes, rate it, review it, subscribe if you haven't. And be sure to tune in Thursday for Indie Film Weekly. Thanks for listening.